하나 하해
하해
하해 하해 하해 하해 하해 하나 하해
From the Amazon basin, from the magnificent redwoods of California to the icy majesty of the Arctic, life on Earth faces an unprecedented threat from careless development. Join Terra Verde over lunch today to find out about the unfolding future of the planet. Hi, I'm Prothap Chatterjee. Welcome to Terra Verde, a weekly environmental radio show on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. And of course, streaming on World Wide Web at www.kpfa.org. This week is World Oceans Week, and joining us to discuss the threat to the world's oceans will be Marsha McNutt, who's the president of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute down in Monterey Bay. And she'll join us by phone. And joining us in the studio will be Tim Eichenberg, the director of the Pacific Regional Office of the Ocean Conservancy, who joins us in the studio. And he'll be talking to us a bit about a new bill that has been passed in California to limit ocean fish farming, and also to discuss the impact of this fish farming both on our health as well as especially on the health of the world's oceans. So we hope to have in just a second here now, I think, Marsha McNutt, who's the president of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, who'll give us a little bit of an overview of the threats to the world oceans. Marsha McNutt, are you with us? Marsha is with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which is affiliated with, but actually very different from, the Monterey Bay Aquarium itself. It was founded by the same people. It does research. And Marsha, I think you're with us?
I am.
Thank you so much. So if you want to say a quick word, I just explained that the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute is affiliated with and was founded by the same people, but it's actually a different organization than the aquarium that many of us have visited and know so much about.
That's correct. The aquarium and the research institute consider themselves to be sister institutions. We try to mutually support each other's missions, but we have distinct missions. The aquarium's mission is to inspire conservation of the ocean, whereas the research institute is designed to create new capacity and new understanding for exploring, observing, and providing better management strategies for the ocean.
So tell us a little bit about what the biggest threats today are to the world's oceans. You guys actually have, do you have ships that go out there and do research long-term and that sort of thing, looking at, and probably, I guess, like Woods Hole and people like that, you probably use a lot of satellite data and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. We use all techniques that we have at our disposal to try to understand the ocean. And I would say that from the standpoint of our research institution, such as MBARI, if we were to say what is the biggest current threat to the ocean, it's probably our incredible lack of understanding of what's in the ocean and what goes on in the ocean. Probably the best way for your listeners that I can describe it is I think they're well aware that offshore Monterey here, we have a large underwater marine sanctuary, the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And this area of protected seafloor is more than four times the size of Yosemite National Park. But let's suppose that you are a park ranger, but instead of being a park ranger for Yosemite, you're a park ranger here for the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And the equivalent is that you have never, as a park ranger, actually been able to walk on the surface of your area that you are supposed to protect, that the park is entirely encased in darkness because light can't penetrate to the bottom of the seafloor under any circumstances, and therefore all you know about what's in this large area that you have to protect is from but, you know, a handful, literally, of remotely operated vehicles that are able to occasionally visit it. And you can imagine how difficult it would be to make sure that any policies, any management strategies you have are correct when you have so little understanding of what's down there.
Indeed. And but what, with the little knowledge we have, and I appreciate the fact that it's almost impossible to understand really what's happening at the very bottom of the ocean, what would you say the biggest threats are? I mean, these might be geological threats, but I assume that a lot of them are probably human-inspired.
Sure.
I just saw this film that you may have seen, An Inconvenient Truth, and it just showed these very dramatic impacts of climate change on the world's oceans, primarily, actually.
Well, one of the areas in terms of climate in which we're doing a lot of basic research right now at our research institute is trying to understand what the impacts are going to be in the ocean of the increased release of CO2 into the atmosphere. What a lot of people don't realize is after CO2 is released into the atmosphere, the fate for most of it is ultimately to be taken up by the surface ocean, where the first thing it does is it increases the acidity of the surface ocean. So the pH drops and the ocean becomes progressively more acid as all the CO2 in the atmosphere gets dissolved into the ocean. One question we're trying to address to begin with is whether photosynthesis will continue to exist in the ocean in another couple hundred years at the rate that we're putting CO2 into the atmosphere. And when you consider that more than 50% of all the photosynthesis that happens on this planet happens in the ocean, to create enough acidity in the ocean that photosynthesis there would entirely stop is a very scary concept. It would mean that fisheries would all die and the ocean would basically become largely a wasteland.
And the other problem, of course, is as the ice caps melt and larger quantities of water are released, that's going to have a tremendous impact on the low-lying coastal areas, but also on fish populations and species and that sort of thing, I imagine.
Well, the effect of the melting of the ice caps has the global ramification of the rise in sea level, and that currently is really not a research question. We know how much sea level will rise, and we can do very specific predictions of which regions are at greatest risk. You can imagine that much of the state of Florida ceases to exist after the ice caps melt. In terms of the ecological ramifications of melting of the ice caps, some of the most severe ones are in the polar regions themselves, because there are entire communities in those areas of the planet that depend on the ice as a substrate, as a source of freshened water, etc. And if you get rid of those ice caps entirely, there are all sorts of branches of the food chain that can no longer survive.
And indeed also human populations up there in the Arctic Circle.
Yes, and for those who have not taken a look at it, there was a very nice series, maybe nice isn't the right word, but a very eye-opening series of articles in the New Yorker about some of the impacts on human populations in polar regions because of the fact that the absence of ice changes their lifestyle and negates their lifestyle completely, and also of the effect of rising sea level on some island nations in which basically they will have no islands left after sea level rises.
Marsha McNutt of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, thanks so much. If you can stay, I'd like to have you continue on. I don't know how much time you have, as you agreed to be on the show at very short notice. This one of the things that we want to discuss, and maybe your institute has done some work on this, is the issue of fish farming and ocean out in the oceans. I'm not sure if this is something you've looked at, but we're joined here in the studio by Tim Eichenberg of the Ocean Conservancy, who is actually just off a plane from Washington, D.C., where he was testifying in Congress about the impact of the vast ocean the possibilities of future, but also the current impact of aquaculture, which has also a lot of impact on the environment. And I don't know if the Monterey Bay Institute Aquarium Research Institute does any work on that.
Simply indirectly from having looked at what some of the effects are of pollution, nitrate loading, et cetera, in the ocean, some of which are relevant to the fish farming issue. But I'm happy to stay on the line and answer any questions later.
That'd be great. Well, maybe actually, Tim, if you sort of introduce the issue of aquaculture and Marcia just mentioned the issue of nitrates, where do these nitrates come from and what do they do? How does this, you know, and what impact does it have on coastal ecosystems and us, I guess?
Well, the nitrates come from fish waste. And aquaculture really is a fairly large industry, and the part of the aquaculture that we're most concerned with at the Ocean Conservancy is fish farming. Fish farming is the raising of large numbers of fish in net pens, suspended net pens in the ocean. They're tethered to the ocean bottom. And these fish produce an enormous amount of wastes, and the wastes do produce nitrogen, and that's where the nitrates come from. And if these are done in the improper location, if they're not located properly, if they're located in shallow waters or waters where the circulation is poor, you can get dead zones coming arising from underneath these cages, which kill all marine life underneath them. They can bury a lot of the benthic habitat underneath these wastes. And you can create things like algal blooms from these nitrogen, and that can lead to red tides, which are deadly to fish and even humans.
But let's put this a little bit of perspective. These fish farms are to create fish for us to eat. And in fact, 80% of the fish that we eat here in the United States comes from outside the country and largely from fish farms. Would that be an accurate...
I think worldwide, about 40% of all seafood now comes from aquaculture, and that's both from fish farms and shellfish, like shrimp and oysters and clams and so forth.
And again, to differentiate, you have sort of fish with hard shells, which we're not talking about, which are like oysters and mussels and scallops, I guess. And then the soft shellfish, which I don't know if that's the technical term, that's the one that I use, which is actually quite destructive to mangrove ecosystems. And then the farmed salmon, for example, is that right?
Right. The farming shrimp has vastly different impacts than fish farming or shellfish farming, like oysters, clams, mussels, and those kinds of things. The shrimp farms are usually carved out of mangrove forests, and mangrove forests is where fish breed in southern populations, and they're very critical to the marine ecosystem. And what they do is they destroy these mangrove groves, and they build ponds for the shrimp, and they produce an enormous amount of waste. And so what we're very concerned about is the destruction of marine habitat from shrimping and from the rise in finfish farming. It's called finfish as opposed to shellfish farming.
And this is salmon and other fish.
And tuna.
And tuna. Tuna's farmed. Where's tuna farmed? I'm curious.
Mexico.
And also in Australia, there's a huge amount of bluefin tuna now that's being raised in southern Australia.
So now if I go into a seafood restaurant, let's say right here in San Francisco, unless it says wild salmon or wild tuna, it's very likely to have come from a fish farm?
If it's tuna, yes. If it's salmon, that's probably true. I would recommend for your listeners to ask where the food is coming from before you purchase any seafood in a restaurant or a fish market. And if they say it's farmed, I would inquire whether it's being sustainably farmed. If they say yes, I would ask for more evidence that it is sustainable, because there's really no certification of these fish farm operations, and I'd say the vast majority of them are not being farmed sustainably.
One of the places is Marcia's, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, the sister institute of Mbari, where Marcia works, that actually has a little card that explains where you can buy fish. Is that, Marcia, I'm not sure if you work with them on that particular seafood consumption little pocket chart.
Yes, and I would say that the cards that they put out, of course, are very carefully researched and very useful for consumers to have. But one of the problems is that often when they will go to the grocery store or even a restaurant, sometimes the wait staff or the servers will not have a good answer, or maybe not even the right answer as to where the seafood came from, which makes it difficult for consumers to know that they've made a wise choice. Therefore, the aquarium's working right now with other groups, such as the Ocean Conservancy, to try to institute some sort of certification programs such that restaurants and wholesalers, for example, Walmart, would be able to label their fish products as being consistent with the standards of some of these organizations, which have a reputation for holding the highest standards for sustainable seafood.
You're tuned to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. I'm Prothap Chatterjee, and this is Terra Verde, a weekly environmental radio show. You were just listening to the voice of Marsha McNutt, who's the president of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, who joins us by phone, and Tim Eichenberg, the director of the Pacific Regional Office of the Ocean Conservancy, who's here in the studio. There was actually a caller that just called in and asked about tilapia, and I noticed in some of the publications people talked about how because tilapia is a vegetarian fish, it's actually less impactful. And I'm curious because I know, certainly being part Indian, that a lot of this tilapia and catfish are often raised actually on lands. It may not be as environmentally destructive, but often lands that are taken from people and used to feed, I guess, wealthier people in other countries. So I don't know if that's something that either of you would want to address.
Well, I can make a comment on it. Namely, if you look at the land farming we do in terms of what kind of animals we raise on land for human consumption, they are sheep, beef, chickens, etc., pigs, and what they all have in common is that they're all vegetarians. We don't eat tigers. We don't ranch wolves. And the reason for that is it's just not a very efficient way to create protein for human consumption. And therefore, the issue with tuna and other carnivores is that it, again, just like raising tigers for human consumption on land, is not a very efficient way to go about it.
Indeed. Let me actually ask you a question about, and Tim actually is just back from Washington, D.C., where he was testifying on this new scheme by the Bush administration. Maybe both of you can speak to this. The idea of creating these giant pens out in the ocean where they would do, because we import so much fish, I understand is the reason, the idea is to reduce the trade deficit by growing fish off the coast. And Tim, why don't you explain it? Because I don't really know much about this. And maybe Marsha, you know something about this too.
Well, the Bush administration is concerned about the seafood trade deficit, which is about $8 or $9 billion a year.
Which is second to only oil, apparently.
Yeah. So one of their solutions to that is to increase, they're proposing a fivefold increase in aquaculture production by the year 2020. And in furtherance of that goal, they are proposing legislation now in Congress, which I just got back from testifying before the Senate Commerce Committee on this bill. It's Senate Bill 1195. And what we're very concerned about in this bill is that it has no environmental standards. There's no standards to prevent the escape of farmed fish into the marine environment. There's no standards to prevent disease and parasites from being distributed from the farm fish to the wild fish. There's no standard to minimize the use of drugs and chemicals and antibiotics that they use in the feed to try to prevent disease in these animals from spreading. There's no standard to prevent wastes, to minimize the amount of waste that are produced by these fish from entering the marine environment. And you address the issue of protein in the oceans. And one of the issues that we're concerned about is that it generally for carnivorous fish, which are not tilapia, but other fish like salmon, for example, or tuna, it takes roughly 4 or 5 pounds of wild fish ground up into fish meal to grow 1 pound of farmed fish. Well, that's a net decrease, a net loss of protein in the oceans. So if the Bush administration is thinking that they're going to solve the problem of declining fisheries and ocean health through aquaculture, then they need to take a much better look at some standards that would minimize the use of fish meal and fish oils in fish feeds so that we're not actually decreasing the amount of protein in the oceans, but we're actually trying to add to that.
So now one of the reasons for that is because salmon is very popular because it's so good for you because of the omega-3 fatty acids. But if you were to raise them on if they were vegetarian salmon, they wouldn't have those. Can you have vegetarian salmon?
You can lower the fish meal content in some of the feeds, you probably can't have an entirely vegetarian salmon, which is one reason why people should think about alternatives. If you're going to get farmed fish, they should look at alternatives than carnivorous fish, such as tilapia. However, I must say that tilapia, there may be other problems with raising tilapia that you raise, which is, you know, where they're raising them and the kinds of wastes that are produced by these fish, and where those wastes go, and chemicals that are being used in the feeds. One study that's been done has shown that farmed salmon actually has higher levels of contaminants in them than the wild salmon do, higher levels of PCBs, dioxins, and other pollutants and contaminants that are in the environment that come through the feed. They're biomagnified in the feed, and then they're transmitted into the farmed fish. So actually, wild fish may be healthier, and it may have the same, you know, omega-3 fatty acid content, fatty acids, but they may have higher levels of contaminants in farmed feed. So it's something to think about.
Wild fish, Matt. Now, and just since we're on this topic of contaminants and fish being raised in farms, here in California, we do have some farmed, we have aquaculture. Some of this is, I guess, oysters in Tomales Bay. Is that either dangerous for us or is it bad for the environment?
No, we're not concerned about the shellfish like oysters in Tomales Bay and so forth. They're actually filter feeders. They filter out contaminants and nitrogen and so forth. They actually make the water cleaner. What we're concerned about is the new upcoming threat from farmed fish. And right now, California does not have any commercial fish farming operations in the ocean. However, we recently got a law passed. It was signed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it was introduced by Senator Joe Simidian from the Bay Area, that would install very, very stringent standards on raising native fish here in California. California already has a law that prohibits raising salmon or non-native species or genetically modified species in fish farms. So this bill that was just signed on May 26th would regulate the raising of native fish populations. We're talking about things like halibut, tuna, could be rockfish or sea bass, fish like that. That are being raised, they're at least they're native populations, and so if they escape, you're not going to be releasing a non-native or exotic species into the oceans. However, there's still those impacts that we discussed earlier that you have to be concerned about, the threat of disease and parasites from these fish, and the use of chemicals and antibiotics in the feed, and the amount of fish feed that's used, and the ecosystem effects of removing those fish out of the ecosystem and feeding them to farm fish. So this bill that was passed and signed by Governor Schwarzenegger on May 26th would put stringent standards on regulating those kinds of inputs into fish farms. And when those fish farms now are installed in California, we don't know when that will be because there aren't any right now. The industry knows what's expected of them, and we hope that they will do a much better job than they have done in the past.
But what the Bush administration is proposing could result in fish farms in other places such as Oregon or New Hampshire, where they actually have actually experimented with creating these sort of giant floating, flying saucer kind of fish farms.
Right. These are all experiments that they're doing right now.
It hasn't happened.
No, it hasn't. They're actually doing the experiments, but they haven't been done on a commercial basis yet. But what we're concerned about this federal bill is that California now has passed stringent laws in state waters, which go out to 3 miles. But beyond 3 miles is federal waters. And that's where this federal bill would not protect California from operations that are just beyond our borders in the oceans that would be beyond 3 miles offshore. So if we could be doing a good job and requiring that all fish farms are sustainable here and are protecting the environment. But if there's a weak federal law, we're going to have a hard time protecting ourselves against that.
Well, Marcia, since we still have you, one more question, because Tim brought up this issue of farmed salmon and farmed fish escaping out into the wild environment and therefore into the greater ocean, and I'm wondering if that's something you can address as to what is the impact of these escaped prison farm fish, shall we say, out into the larger ocean.
That isn't a research topic which we have dealt with specifically here. Other than to say, I think the threats that people have identified are indeed possible, but yet I don't know right now of any smoking gun of a situation where someone has identified a true environmental disaster that resulted from that, but nevertheless, the farmed fish have escaped. We know that, and they do interbreed with other populations, and the whole one of the main justifications behind the legislation that Joe Smidian was responsible for shepherding through the legislature was the fact that to try to keep these genetically modified fish from being farmed in California waters.
We could have that problem now of Bush versus Schwarzenegger on right at that 3-mile limit.
Well, when I testified yesterday, Barbara Boxer is on the committee, Senator Boxer from California. And she was very complimentary about the law that California passed and said that the federal government should look to California as a model.
We'll have to wrap up in about 2 minutes. I'm wondering if actually both of you want to actually talk a little bit about how people can find out more information about your institute's websites, phone numbers, that sort of thing. Let's start with you, Marcia McNutt, President.
Yes, if the listeners would like to go to www.mbari.org, we have a website in which there's lots of good information on there, and in fact, our institutional annual reports have very readable articles on some of our latest accomplishments, and all of those can be easily accessed from the web.
Again, that's www.mbari.org. Is there a phone number that people can call for?
Yes. The phone number here is 775- Gosh.
And of course, it starts with 831. So 831.
It's 831. And, well, actually, let me mention something else, too. I'd really love it if the listeners could put on their calendars that we have an annual open house. And the open house this year is going to be on July 15th. And that is the day that we just open everything up to the public and have everything out on display, and it's a wonderful, fun time here in Moss Landing. And the phone number to get general information on the open house is 831-775-1700.
Okay, again, that's 831-775-1700.
That's right.
And July 15th is
July
the open house.
July 15th is our big open house.
If you want to go down there. Great. And Tim Eichenberg, if I may, what is the website for the Ocean Conservancy, and is there a phone number you can be reached at?
Yes.
The office can be reached at?
It's www.oceanconservancy.org.
And that's www.oceanconservancy.org. Is there a phone number for your offices?
Yes. Our offices, telephone number is 415-979-0900.
And again, that is 415-979-0900. That just about wraps it up for Terra Verde today. I'm Protheb Chatterjee, and joining me were Tim Eichenberg, the director of the Pacific Regional Office of the Ocean Conservancy, and also Marcia McNutt, who's the president of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Erica Bridgman and Nick Alexander, who engineered this show. I